Thank you. Thank the organizers for inviting me. This is a hybrid talk. Not only is it a geometry talk and a PDE conference, but it also hybrid in the sense that I don't really use overhead projectors, but I have a few slides, so I'll go back and forth and we'll see how that works. So what I want to talk about is an inverse problem from geometry. The idea today is to sort of survey what's known and sort of lead into some things that Gunther is going to talk about in the next couple of days. There are two lectures. This is just the outline. Today I'll state the problem and show some examples to show why it's not always true, and then set up the appropriate conjectures, mention some history, introduce another problem called lens rigidity that's related to the boundary rigidity problem. And then I'm actually going to prove something. It's the only thing I'm going to try and prove, since it's not so hard and it shows up again. Anyway, so I'll talk about a proof. And then the lecture two is just the outline, but since I'm not going to get that far today, let me not bother with that. All right, so now for a while, I'm going to see how this works. Now I'm going to shift gears. So what we're going to be talking about are compact Riemannian manifolds. So this is my notation for a Riemannian manifold with a boundary and a Riemannian metric G. Okay. So here, yes. So M is going to be compact. And given a Riemannian manifold with boundary, for a pair of boundary points X and Y, you induce a function, a distance function, which I'll denote d sub g, x comma y, which is, of course, the infimum of paths, length of gamma, where gamma is the path in M from x to y. And so it's, I sometimes call this the chordal distance between the boundary points. And the question, does dg determine g? Or to what extent does dg determine g? When does dg determine g? I mean, one could ask the stronger question, given dg, find g, but I'm not going to touch on that very much. That's much harder. At the moment, just when do you have uniqueness? And, of course, you don't have uniqueness in any real sense. So the first reason why you don't have uniqueness is if you take any diffeomorphism from M to M, such that, so it's a diffeo, with F restricted to the boundary, the identity map, then, of course, if you pull back the metric by the function, you get a new metric. It's isometric to the old metric, but it's a new metric, and it'll have the same boundary distance function. So this has the same. dg, which is what I call, I guess I didn't say that anywhere, but that's the boundary distance function. So so that leads to the definition we say that M del M G is boundary rigid. If this is the only other way. So it's boundary rigid if for every other Riemannian metric, which induces the same distance function, it's isometric by an isometry that leaves the boundary the identity map. So the question, the boundary rigidity question, is basically which manifolds are boundary rigid? And the first point, of course, is they're not all boundary rigid, or else I wouldn't have phrased the problem that way. And the easiest way to construct a counterexample, this is supposed to be a metric on the disk, where you have some points that are far away from the boundary. Right? You've got some peak somewhere. So if you look at distances between boundary points, it doesn't see that peak. So you can change the metric or the topology or anything you like in here, and it won't change the distance function on the boundary. So it's certainly not true that every manifold with boundary, the Riemannian metric is determined by the distance for this kind of obvious reason. Another one that's kind of a edge case is the hemisphere. So in any dimension, if you take the hemisphere, and that's G, so let's say G0 is a hemisphere, hemisphere G0, and then you change the metric in any way you like just so that it's always bigger than G0. Say it's still G0 on the boundary, but you make it just larger. Then the distance between any boundary point still runs along the boundary. Right? So before, every geodesic actually minimizes in a hemisphere. But between boundary points, the minimizing geodesic is running also runs along the boundary. So if you make everything bigger, you haven't changed the distance on the boundary. This is an edge case because, as I'll mention, any compact subdomain of a hemisphere is, in fact, boundary rigid. But the hemisphere itself isn't. So those are some examples of non-rigidity. So we need some condition on the manifold in order to for it possibly to be boundary rigid, to pose some conjectures or some problems. The one nice thing you'd like, and we will get them eventually, is you'd like the condition to be on the boundary distance function. For applications, which I'll get into in a little bit, I won't say much about them, you're given the boundary distance function. It's the sort of thing where it's an inverse problem. What you know is the boundary distance function. You don't know the metric, so you don't want to make too many assumptions about the metric. You want to make assumptions about the boundary distance function. And so some of the conditions, when I first state them, are going to sound like they're conditions on the metric, but they can be turned into conditions on the boundary distance function. So the first condition, so now we're looking at conditions that we can hope to make conjectures about, just basically to eliminate these cases. The first one is simple. And not that the problems you get are simple here, but the manifolds have a nice form. So M del MG has the property that for every P and Q in the boundary, there exists a unique in M, let's say in M. Leave it at the boundary, that might be better. So I'm stating this in terms of the metric. There exists a unique geodesic from P to Q, a unique geodesic, from, and the boundary of M is strictly convex. So what we're talking about is a ball. Topologically, we're talking about an N ball. And every pair of points is a unique way, unique geodesic between them. And the boundary is strictly convex, means the second fundamental form, all of the principal curvatures are positive. Turns out, and I'll sort of get to why in a second, this is essentially a condition on the boundary distance function, even though it looks like I've given you a condition on the whole metric inside. So this is a natural setting. So the strict convexity, for instance, rules out the hemisphere. The hemisphere, the boundary is totally geodesic. Also, there's non-uniqueness of geodesics here. Sorry. The boundary between antipodal points, there's non-unique minimizing geodesics. So that's simple. A second class, which looks like at first... Yeah? No, I mean that the second fundamental form has positive eigenvalues. Okay. If you want to, call it strong convexity. You could ask for simply strict. When you say simple, do you mean strong or strict? Or well, let me stick with strong. I mean, in some sense, there, as you'll see, there are more general notions one could ask for. Let me stick with, I'll call it strictly, but I mean what you mean by strong. The second is subdomains of simple. Which is quite a bit more general than simple. For example, subdomains of simple include every subdomain of Euclidean space with smooth boundary. I didn't emphasize the smoothness, but I probably should here. For me, boundaries are smooth, unless otherwise stated. A lot of these theorems might be true without smooth boundary, but let me stick to the smooth boundary case. So subdomains of simple, and it turns out this sometimes there are significant problems in getting from things being true for simple to things being true for subdomains of simple. And it's a much broader class of manifolds with boundary. Okay, then the third setting I want to talk about is SGM, which I'll eventually have a slide up here on this condition. Normally, when I give talks, when I only have an hour, I give a false definition, false one, and I'll give that one now, and then I'll come back and give you the essentially a true definition. And this is that all geodesics, all, non-grazing geodesics, and I'll explain what I mean by that. Are the unique minimizing path between the endpoints. And this is a bit of a so this is a grazing geodesic. It touches on the boundary in an interior point. So a non-grazing, just any geodesic segment that only hits the boundary at the endpoints, that's what non-grazing means. But all of those are the unique minimizing paths. That's essentially what SGM means. And I'll come back later to say exactly what SGM means. Okay. So these are the conjecture is that any one of these cases, you get boundary rigidity. These, like I said, isn't a conjecture. These are, if you like, three separate conjectures. That conjecture is really strong. So sorry, conjecture means you have some reason, some strong reasons for believing it. Let me just say open questions, or whether you have boundary rigidity for any of these three categories. So the history of this problem, after having set it up, goes back to 1905 with Herglotz. Well, I probably shouldn't try to pronounce these names because I'll destroy them then. Eichert and Zopritz, or something like that. And they considered radially symmetric metrics. On the three ball, because they were interested in modeling the Earth. And the idea was to determine the density inside the Earth by sending sound waves through it. And so the question was, can you determine the density of the Earth by that kind of information? And so the natural simplifying assumption was that it was radially symmetric, and they resolved it. So radially symmetric, and if you look at two different radially symmetric balls that have the same data distances on the boundary, then in fact they're isometric. That was 1905. This also is probably why in the isotropic case, which I'll mention in a second, is called the inverse kinematic problem of seismology, because of these guys who are interested in the seismology applications. Then in Romanov, he linearized it near radial symmetry. So he was, what's first order changes off radial symmetry? Can you still determine the metric up to first order? And that turned out to be a question about, can you determine the value of a function from its integrals along geodesics in the radially symmetric? So the function would be what you're using to push off of the radial. And when you linearize it, it's a question of whether the integral of the function, given that the integral is zero, does that force the function to be zero? And then isotropic metrics. And this I'm actually going to prove today. This is the one proof I'm going to give. So, in fact, for I think most applications, the applications I know of, this is the interesting case, where you have a density, such as the brain. If you're doing medical imaging, for instance, you may want to try to determine what the brain looks like from measurements from the outside with small energy. So, very briefly, not that I really do any medical imaging, but standard CAT scans use X-rays, high energy rays that travel in straight lines, and you figure out how much of the ray gets absorbed on that route to give you an estimate of the density along that line. One of the things you know about that is you know the path it took. It's energetic. It took a straight line path. If you're using less energetic things, you maybe could get more data from that less energetic, because you don't kill the patient as fast. You can use less energy and get more data, but you don't know which path it took, and that's really where this problem comes in. The geodesic paths that are taken, since you don't know the brain yet, that's why it's much more complicated, this question of inverting. So here now, we want to actually determine F for medical imaging questions. Your sound wave, you don't know what the shortest path it traveled is. All you get is the travel time. and you're trying to reconstruct that. So anyway, this is one of the main interests in this problem in the long run, and that you assume that the new metric is a function of the metric, some sort of base metric, function times. I mean, at first approximation, it's isotropic, right? I mean, it certainly in CAT scans, you're assuming isotropy. It would be nice if I could if we can solve the isotropic case, already be great. But sure, I'd love to be able to say, yeah, because I'm interested in the anisotropic case myself, so I'd love to be convinced that there's. But I think first you want to solve the isotropic case, but good. What? Oh, the MRI. Oh, okay, good. I'll have to get those pictures so I can use them for if I'm trying to impress people with my applicability at some point. So anyway, this case, the isotropic case has been resolved. In the simple setting, it was done by Mokhometov in 75 for n equal to 2 and for all dimensions in 82. And the SGM case I did in 91. And that's the one I'll give today because it's short. This proof's not so bad. Okay, so most of the talk is going to be an anisotropic case because the isotropic case is resolved in some sense. And for general Riemannian manifolds, this is what's known. So the following are boundary rigid. Never done that before. It's always sometimes the following are equivalent. I do that for. Anyway, the following are boundary rigid. So, put the names of people who did it. Michel in 81 showed that compact subdomains of R2 or H2. H2 being the hyperbolic plane. So any compact subdomain of R2 or H2 is boundary rigid. And not only those, but compact subdomains of this, or the open round hemisphere. I already mentioned this. So if you take a compact subdomain that's inside the open round hemisphere, then it's boundary rigid. In fact, it's not so hard to extend this to take any SGM subdomain of a round sphere. It's boundary rigid. Then Gromov in 83 proved compact subdomains of Rn. So if you start off with a flat n-dimensional piece, you can't change the metric inside without changing the boundary distance function. And then as a consequence of Besson-Courtois-Galot, so there was a theorem in the mid-90s called resolve the conjecture of Gromov called the minimal entropy conjecture. I won't tell you what their theorem is, but one of the myriad of consequences are that compact subdomains of rank one of negatively curved, how about this, negatively curved symmetric spaces. So hyperbolic space, for instance, any compact subdomain of hyperbolic space, or complex hyperbolic space, quaternionic hyperbolic space, or the negatively curved Cayley plane. Those are the examples, but compact subdomains of those. And so these are all rather special. In fact, these are all constant curvature metrics. This is the next closest thing to being constant curvature metrics are these symmetric spaces. So for results where the metric isn't constant curvature, there's myself and Otal independently in the early 90s. There's slightly different statements, but the consequence is that two-dimensional SGM manifolds of curvature less than zero are boundary rigid. So for surfaces, if the original surface has negative curvature, you compare it to any other metric. If it has the same boundary distance function, then it's isometric to that other metric. And then the nicest result, which was done last year, test off and pretty much finishes up the two-dimensional case, almost, not quite. And O3, and you'll hear about that tomorrow, is that two-dimensional simple and subdomains of simple are boundary rigid. So no curvature assumption, just that they're simple. So this result, so before you're talking about being clients of differential geometry, in some sense this result is a client of inverse problems. This is coming from the Dirichlet de Neumann problem, the solution to this geometry question, if you like. So, but anyway, you'll hear about that. Okay, so before getting to the things you can find out early without too much work, let me state the question that I think is key to all of these problems. No one's answered this question, by the way, but this is the key question that sounds easy. So take a Riemannian metric ball, and what I mean is, unit. So take a unit ball with some Riemannian metric, and make any assumption you like. At the moment, you could assume that it's negatively curved, if you like. You assume the boundary's convex. Whatever you assume, you get the consequence, of course, would be a little less if you assume more, but no conjugate points, or that's the same as all geodesics minimizing running across. Whatever natural assumption you want to assume here. And say G has same boundary distance function, so I guess I could have said that more quickly as the boundary distance function for G is the same as the boundary distance function for G0. Then the question is G a unit ball? Which it's very quick to see that just comes down to asking, if for G, is there a point that's a unit distance from the boundary, from every boundary point? That's what it amounts to. Now, I don't know any way of proving this in any setting without proving that G0 is isometric to G. And therefore, of course, it's got a point, unit distance from the boundary. But the only proofs anywhere where this is where this happens is done by proving that they're isometric. But if you start looking at it, you think you've almost got it. You know, you can prove all geodesics that leave the boundary perpendicularly, come back out the boundary perpendicularly after time two. Those kind of, that sort of information you find out in a hurry, just they don't all, you can't force them all to go through the same point. But if you could prove this, you can use this result to prove all kinds of boundary rigidity questions. This is really the crux of the matter. And if I have time, which I know I won't, I might come back to explain how you could use something like this to prove a lot of things. But this is really the crucial open question. All right. So now let's talk a little bit about what can you tell right away. If you know that the two metrics have the same boundary distance function, what information does that give you? The first thing to note, that if, so again, now we're in this situation where dg is dg0, then if you look at the Riemannian metric g restricted to the boundary, that's the same as the Riemannian metric dg0, g0 restricted to the boundary. That's just because the Riemannian metric on the boundary is the length metric. So there's a standard way of giving a, if you're given a distance function, a metric in the sense of metric spaces on a manifold, then you can construct, so here the distance you're giving is the chordal distance. Then if you use that, you can define lengths of curves by taking limits of little arcs, and the resulting metric on the boundary is just the Riemannian metric. So knowing the chordal distances, you know the metric. So that's easy. So we also, if we have the same boundary distance, we can talk about what an inward pointing direction is for the two different metrics. What does it mean to be the same inwardly pointing direction? Oh, geez. A direction being a unit vector, well, you look at the projection onto the boundary. For each vector on the boundary of length less than one, it's exactly one unit vector pointing inward. So since we know how to correspond that tangent vectors on the boundary, we know how to talk about corresponding inwardly pointing vectors. So I guess that was my second comment, that we can talk about that. And the third comment is if we have the following picture, so whatever I want to call them, Q prime and Q, for reasons that will come up in a second. And you have this geodesic going from Q prime to Q. Then the outward vector, if you look at the gradient at Q of the distance from Q prime to dot, that's some vector V. Then the gradient at Q of the distance restricted to the boundary, dg, of Q prime and dot, is just the orthogonal projection of V to the boundary. Right? So if you're looking at over here at Q, if you actually knew the whole distance function on the whole manifold, which you don't, then the gradient is just the unit vector pointing directly away, the gradient of the distance function. So if you restrict to the boundary, the gradient of the boundary distance function is just the orthogonal projection of that vector back. Okay, and this is what leads to Gromov's condition. So I told you I was going to tell you what SGM meant. Well, let me try this. I don't think we need to turn off the lights. Maybe we do. Is that, can people see that well enough? Yeah. All right, anyway, these were the conditions that I mentioned before. There were simple subdomains of simple. So Gromov gave a criterion for what he thought was the right set of conditions. And the point about Gromov's criterion is that it's only in terms of the boundary distance function. Right? He's not going to talk about geodesics in the interior or anything else. So here's the condition. It says, for every point on the boundary, I mean, I should be drawing pictures while I'm doing this. I'll do it over here. Oops. So for every vector q on the point q on the boundary, and so here's your point q, and you have a vector of length less than 1 tangent to the boundary. So that's going to define for us, in fact, a unit vector going inward. Actually, it's the opposite direction. There'd be a unit vector going outward, a unique unit vector going outward. We keep that in mind, what he's talking about. So with every subunit vector, there's a unique Q1 in the boundary with two different conditions. So there's going to be, basically, you find the Q1 by following this geodesic backwards till the first time, I call it Q1 or Q prime? Q1. Following it backwards till the first time it hits the boundary. So he says there's a unique Q1 such that the gradient of the distance function back here is the function, the direction you're given. And the second condition on this Q1 is that it's the first one you see. So it is possible that, you know, if you follow the geodesic back, it would do this and hit again. And he says this is not your Q1. This is your Q1. There's a unique one which is not, has nothing in between it and Q. That's what the second condition is. So what the point is that every geodesic that leaves the boundary minimizes. So given a vector V to begin with, that's length is less than 1, that determines a unique geodesic leaving the boundary. That guy will minimize up until it hits the point again. That's essentially what the criteria is saying. But it's saying a little more. It also says that the gradient of this distance function exists. And the existence of the gradient means there's no conjugate points. It's sort of geodesics don't come back together right there, or else up the first order, or else the gradient wouldn't exist. So it's a slightly... The existence of this gradient is tells you a little bit more about there not being conjugate points. But basically what it's saying is every geodesic that leaves the boundary will minimize until it hits the boundary again. But you can tell that just from the distance function. That's the point of this criterion. So SGM was the last criteria that I mentioned, and that's essentially... Well, it satisfies Gromov's criterion, and there's one other condition. Unfortunately, it takes a couple of paragraphs to state this condition just in terms of DG, but I'll tell you what it is geometrically, so I'm still cheating a little bit with this. But the problem with this condition, this criteria, is that it actually allows there to be geodesics that never hit the boundary, that stay inside forever. It forces any geodesic that ever hits the boundary to minimize till it hits the other side, but it's still possible, it's not so hard to construct examples, where geodesics never hit the boundary. And you really don't want that. You want all your geodesics to hit the boundary. So that there is a way of forcing that to be true just looking at the boundary distance function. Basically, the only way that this can go wrong is if there's a geodesic, infinitely long geodesic, that bounces off the boundary, comes tangent to the boundary, then comes tangent to the boundary again, then comes tangent to the boundary again, infinitely often. That's the only thing that can go wrong. But they happen. It's easy to write down examples that do that. And this SGM just says, no such geodesics exist. Gromov criteria plus that. Okay, so that's the first time I've mentioned this condition sort of thoroughly in a long time. But anyway, it's written down carefully. And the point is that it's only done in terms of the DG. Right, so SGM condition is in DG only. The point being, if you have a different, another manifold with the same boundary distance function, then it's also SGM. One of them is SGM, the other one has to be SGM. The simple case, by the way, if you allow me to lie a little bit and not be too careful, simple is also satisfies Gromov criteria, plus the fact that you can read off that it's strictly convex boundary or strongly convex boundary from the boundary distance function as well. So although simple isn't written down in those terms, you can essentially write it down in terms of just the distance function. All right. How are we doing for time? All right. I think I'll still make it. All right, so notice one of the things about this argument here. It says that from the boundary distance function, you can tell which direction the geodesic from Q prime to Q, by looking at gradients, you can tell which direction it exits in. You can tell which direction, you don't know anything about the geodesic in the inside, but you do know how it comes out the other side. And by flipping the roles of P and Q, Q and Q prime, you can find out where it came in. So in the SGM case, assuming you have these gradients, you can see how geodesics come in and how they go out from the boundary distance function. So this means they're what I call lens equivalent. I think of them as geodesic lenses. They bend, the metrics bend geodesics. So if G0 is SGM and DG0 equals DG, then they are the same. As geodesic lenses. And precisely what I mean by that is for every inward vector, where it comes in and where it goes out is the same, although in between the geodesics could be quite different. But the how long it takes and where they come in and where they go out, they're the same as geodesic lenses. There is a different problem, which is like the boundary rigidity question you can set up for gravitational lenses. But I haven't thought about that. So. But I think in some sense with Gromov's theorem about that subdomains of Euclidean space are rigid, boundary rigid. I sometimes say that says there are no Klingon cloaking devices. That is, if you look at a region in space and you don't see anything there, there's nothing there, right? If it doesn't bend light in some direction or other, then it's Euclidean space. I'm sorry, it's Romulan. Did you tell me this last time I said that? I think you did. Once at the Penn, somebody told me that. Then it's Romulan. Anyway, Klingon, Romulan, whatever. But if you can't see it, it's not there. That's what this says. That's what Gromov's theorem says. So you can ask the question, which metrics are lens rigid? Lens rigidity question. That was one of my things here. Lens rigidity. And it's the same sort of thing, given what Riemannian manifolds with boundaries. So one of the things about geodesic lenses is this little peak I made that I said, well, you don't see it when you're looking at boundary distance functions. The first example, well, it does see it with lenses. My geodesics will climb up to that peak and come back down, and you can arbitrarily change it. So the question as to whether metrics are lens rigid, well, it could be a larger class of metrics that are lens rigid. Could be everything, right? Even hemispheres. You can't do the little game with hemispheres. Well, but it can't be everything. It could have until I show you this example. So here's an example. This is supposed to be a surface of revolution. It's supposed to be a cylinder with a bump in it. And then I do the same size cylinder, and I slide the bump. It's supposed to be the same looking bump. You'll have to live with my drawing. But this is supposed to be the same shaped bump, just slid up a little bit. The geodesic lenses, you can't see where that bump is. From the outside, if you send geodesics down here, they come out the same, whether you send them in for this guy or this guy. So it's not the case that all Riemannian manifolds are lens rigid. There are counterexamples here. There are other counterexamples. I don't mean to say that these are the only ones. In fact, it'll come up again. Bruce Kleiner and I made some examples on metric balls that had this kind of a shape in arbitrary dimensions, something sort of, if you know about Zoll surfaces, the sort of generalized Zoll surfaces up here, but two different metrics on the ball, N ball, that had the same lens, or lens equivalent, but not isometric. So again, in this case, you're still talking about these. These are the most natural settings, but it could be more general. Are they what?
Trapping.
Oh, they're always going to be trapping. All the examples that are known are trapping. I don't have any non-trapping examples. Right? This is also trapping. There's a whole open sets worth. It's not just trapping. A whole set of positive measure of geodesics never get out. Yeah, that's true. So one might ask, as an open question, are there any non-trapping examples? Non-trapping is this bit about, trapping means the geodesic stays forever inside, never hits the boundary. Okay, so I mentioned there were, So using this fact, one gets the following function between the unit tangent bundles of G0 and G, which will show up a lot in the next talk. So G0 and G1 SGM, hence their lens equivalent. And if there exists a function f, which maps the unit tangent bundle in the zero metric over to the unit tangent bundle in the one metric, which commutes with the geodesic flow. So f composed with g0t is g1t composed with f, and I'll explain what I mean by that. And I'll show you what the map looks like. Let's see if I can draw something that looks vaguely the same. Depends on the definition of vague. So if you start off with you want to find out where to send this unit vector. So you follow the geodesic backwards. I want it to come in perpendicularly. And it comes back to a certain point in a certain direction. By SGM, they always hit the boundary. And then you go over here to that same initial direction and follow the geodesic for the same length. And because it's lens equivalent, you haven't hit the boundary yet. And take that unit vector. This is, if this is V, This is f of v. So it maps, every unit vector here goes to a unit vector over here. And it has the property that, I mean, it's built. Yes, I should say with the geodesic flow. So the geodesic flow in a unit tangent bundle, if you want to flow by time t, it says take your vector, follow the geodesic that starts in that direction, follow it out at time t, and take the unit vector at time t. That's a flow. This, of course, what I mean by this equality is whenever this is defined, that's defined, and they're equal. Right? Because, of course, if you take t too long, you'll run out of your boundary. But whenever this side's defined, that side's defined, and they're equal. Whenever either side's defined, the other side is also defined, and they're equal. And it's just built that way. We've taken the unit vectors along a geodesic here, they're all going to be unit vectors along the corresponding geodesic over there, going the same speed. So this is a conjugacy between the geodesic flows, the time-preserving conjugacy, that's what it's called. And we're going to use that, this conjugacy, a bit next time, to set up other problems. So there's a question about differentiability here. So here f is c infinity off, first of all, it's always c zero, and c infinity off a set of measure zero. So the lack of differentiability will happen if you have a geodesic that's doubly tangent, then these vectors here, you're going to have, I mean, they're going to be determined by shooting over here, and if slightly off for vectors nearby, you're going to be shooting from here. There really is no differentiability going on there that you can prove. But they will be continuous. So f's always continuous, and it's differentiable except the set of measure zero. So one thing you get out of this right away is this. So now I'm going to make a statement without a proof. F preserves the canonical contact form. And hence volume form. So there's a natural volume form, the Liouville volume, on the unit tangent bundle of a Riemannian manifold. I'll talk a little bit more about it because I'm going to need it for the one proof I want to give today. And this map will, in fact, preserve that volume form. And in particular, immediate corollary is the volumes of the two are the same. We're trying to prove they're isometric. It's nice to know they have the same volumes. So one corollary you get right away is for the SGM case, if they have the same boundary distance function, the volumes are the same. So before I get into the proof, I wanted to just one comment about this map F. You shouldn't be under the impression that F preserves base points. In fact, that's the key to proving that it's an isometry, that it comes from an isometry. All right, so if you have two vectors, the image under F, at least a priori, we'll have two different base points. And if capital F covers a map little f from the base space, then little f is an isometry. And capital F is just the d little f. So you can't assume that it covers a map on a base. That's the whole game. And in fact, that's why this little ball idea is so important, is that's forcing all the geodesics coming from the boundary, perpendicular to the boundary, to come back through that center. And anyway, I don't have time to explain exactly why, but it's forcing this conjugacy to preserve base point. And it's, by the way, it's easy to see that that if you have this map little f, that it's an isometry, because if you take 2 points x and y reasonably close together, but it doesn't matter, with a geodesic between them, then the image of the unit vectors going from there to there would have to go from f of x to f of y, and they're the same length. Over here is over here. So the distance from x and x to y is the same as the difference distance from f of x to f of y. Right? So that's why f would be an isometry. So the game is to prove, if you like, that this conjugacy covers the map on the base, preserves base points, then you're done. Although that's not what I'm going to do today. All right. So now I want to end with a proof. It'll take a little bit of time to set up, but can't see much, I guess, without the light on. So here's some definitions to set up. So I'm trying to prove, let me remind you what I said I was going to prove, that if you have a metric, an SGM metric, there it is, G0 is an SGM metric, and we're going to look at G1 be a so it's the isotropic case, F squared times G. And so we have these two metrics. VI is going to be the volume form, which is the integral of dx. So I guess dxi is the Riemannian volume form. Um is the G0 unit tangent bundle, as opposed to the G1 unit tangent bundle. They're different, but this is the G0 unit tangent bundle with a Liouville measure du. So I mentioned this Liouville measure, and I'll, if you don't know what it is, maybe this proof will go a little too fast. But anyway, if you know what it is, it's the Liouville measure. So gamma I is the space of unit speed GI geodesic segments. So there's a space. In fact, you can parameterize that by unit vectors pointing inward from the boundary. And I often do, but for this proof, I can just call it gamma I. So, but in general, if you have a unit vector pointing inward from the boundary, you get a geodesic segment until it hits the boundary over there. And gamma I is the space of all geodesic segments. Now, there's a canonical measure on the space of geodesic segments. I say geodesic and geodesic almost in the same sentence. I guess. Sorry about that. Anyway, whatever it is, I don't know. For me, they're both correct. At least I don't say Z and Z in the same sentence. I could do that, too. Anyway, so you have gamma I, d gamma I is some measure, and it's actually pretty easy to write down in terms of vectors starting inward, pointing inward. You can, it's going to be, so this is U plus del M, the plus meaning it's pointing inward from the boundary. Then d gamma I, in terms of these parameters, is du, dv, times the inner product of v with the inward normal. So it's just dv being this, now I'll tell you what that is. This is a measure on The unit vector is pointing inward. Well, there's a standard Riemannian measure on the boundary, and there's a standard measure on the hemispheres. The vector is pointing inward, it's just the product. The product measures. So that's what dv is, and then you throw in this one inner product, and that's exactly what d gamma is. So in some sense, I'm calling something Santalo's formula. In reality, this is Santalo's formula, that the measures look like this. But because I want to use this formula, I'm going to call this Santalo's formula. And what that says is, if you want to integrate any function over the unit tangent bundle, you can instead first integrate over the space of geodesics with this measure of the integral along the geodesic. All right, so here is a unit vector u. You have a geodesic going through it. To measure, integrate over the space of all geodesics, over the unit tangent bundle, you can first integrate along geodesics of those with respect to this measure. That's what the measure is built for. So I call that Santalo's formula. And then some other notation, which looks better if I pushed it up a little. So if gamma is a geodesic in the zero metric, L sub I is just the length of that in the ith metric, whereas script L sub I is the distance between its endpoints in that metric. And of course, since gamma zero was an L zero geodesic and everything's SGM, the length is the same as the distance between its endpoints in the zero metric. But in the one metric, its length in the one metric, it's some curve between those endpoints, but it's not the minimizing curve as far as L1 is concerned, as far as G1 is concerned. So the length might be bigger than the minimum distance. I'm going to issue C is just a constant. It's 1 over the volume of the standard n minus 1 sphere. That says volume of S n minus 1 canonical metric. So round 1 sphere. So it shows up often enough, I thought I'd just call it C. All right, now I'll do the thing that nobody likes you to do. I'm going to cover up and slide down slowly. Sorry. All right. So now we want to prove the theorem. It's one page, one slide. So Santalo's formula, if you plug in f is 1, you integrate the function 1 around the unit tangent bundle. All right, on one side, you get, well, I'm dividing it by the volume of the n minus 1 sphere. That's what the C is there for. You just get the volume. On the other hand, it's the integral over the space of geodesics of the length of that geodesic. Okay, so now we do a little Holder inequality. I have to remind you what lambda was. G1 was lambda squared. Did I say F? Did I switch notation on you? Lambda is supposed to be the function that's multiplying. Lambda squared times G0 is G1. Sorry, I switched on you. So if you integrate lambda squared, it's less than just a Holder inequality. But lambda to the n, that gives you the Riemannian volume in the one metric, and integrate that, you get the Riemannian volume in the zero metric. So it's just Holder. Now we use Santalo a couple of times to see what happens if you integrate lambda, not squared, just lambda. Santalo says, well, it's just integrating lambda across the geodesic, which is the same as the integral of the length in the one metric. So it's lambda, if you integrate lambda times the tangent vector across, you're computing its length in the one metric. Here, you're just adding and subtracting the same thing, the length in the zero metric. And so now the length in the zero metric, we already have that up the top, that's just V0, or the integral of that. And we just, so I just copied the other one down. Nothing going on there. So, I just leave the whole thing out. So hence, I'm just taking this, moving this, I'm just doing all the details. Moving this over the other side, multiplying by 2, you get twice this. Of course, I had to reverse the sign of these because I reversed the sign on there. And that's, now here's the only inequality, I think. Oh, no, the Holder inequality. The only other inequality is going on here, and that's the fact that the length in the one metric is bigger than the distance between the endpoints in the one metric. It's the only inequality that's going on. Okay. And now we just write down what I'm trying to get a stability formula. So you write down what the integral of 1 minus lambda squared is, and you get lambda squared. Okay, this is nothing, right? So it's just squared that out. Oh, I guess I used the fact that the integral of 1 is V0. Anyway, it's nothing. And so now we use these two facts, what the integral of 1 minus lambda is and what the integral of lambda squared is, to convert those into something with volumes. And we end up with this formula, which is the hardest thing to read on the page. And what I... Is that readable? So 1 minus lambda squared is the difference between the volumes plus the integral of the distance, difference between the lengths, of the distances between the boundary points. So, by the way, up to now, I never used SGM. I did use SGM, sorry. But I didn't use that the distance functions were the same. All I used were that one was conformal multiple of the other. So this is why it's a stability estimate. So that the difference between the conformal factor and 1 squared is bounded above by this inequality, by this formula, equation, whatever. Now, if your SGM says that these two guys are the same. Those are the distance between boundary points are the same. And it also says that the volumes are the same. So if it's SGM, you get that lambda is identically 1, which is the theorem I was claiming. It says more than that, but it in particular tells you that the conformal factor is a constant if the volumes are the same and the distances are the same. Okay, so that's the proof, and I guess part of the point is that all the proofs that I know of these kind of things are not done by proving something infinitesimal and building up on it. Instead, it's an integral formula. It's something in the large that you get a bunch of inequalities, and then you say, well, when equality holds, what happens? And usually they're integral inequalities. Let's say always, but that may be a bit of a mistake at this stage. But, okay, so the other thing it shows that I wanted to talk about, and this, did I skip that problem? I think I was running out of time. Let me say what it says, and maybe I'll talk about why I'm interested in this next time a little bit. But it also says for any conformal function, if L1 is bigger than L0, so you have two metrics you're comparing. One's conformal multiple of the other, and the distances in the one metric between endpoints, say they were always bigger than the distances in the zero metric. Well, one conclusion here, since this would be negative, and this side, of course, is positive. This has got to be positive, which means it tells you that the volume associated to one with the bigger distances is bigger, which might be not too surprising, but that's a very important question. In fact, in some sense, the boundary rigidity problem is the stability case of that question. If you know that all the distances are bigger, is the volume bigger? And if you have equality, are they isometric? That's another question I'll talk about briefly. next time where there's been some development. But anyways, maybe I should stop now. I've been talking long enough. This one is, yeah, this is very much, most of them, I don't know, the two-dimensional proof that Otal and I did independently, that relies on Gauss-Bonnet formula. So it's an integral of a curvature, which is not exactly an energy integral, or is that? Would you consider that an energy estimate? Mostly they are. Mostly you do with volumes or something, and it's an energy estimate, but not always. Not all, as far as I can think, especially because of Gauss-Bonnet example. Well, that's automatic. So the point about SGM is, if the other metric has the same boundary distance function, it's automatically SGM. That's why the definition is built out of the boundary distance. That was his purpose in building it, right? So it is automatic. It is essentially, the problem, okay, so I wasn't going to get into this too much because I started thinking about it recently because of the stuff we're doing. And simple does not a priori prohibit conjugacies. You might have a geodesic running from a boundary point to a boundary point, which is conjugate along the endpoints. Every one of these definitions has slight quirks to it. That's the quirk to simplicity. So it doesn't actually satisfy Gromov's criterion. Those particular strange metrics right on the boundary of the simplicity condition might not be Gromov, might not satisfy Gromov's criterion. But if you throw them out, then of course it satisfies Gromov's criteria and the strict convexity you can tell from the boundary distance function. So then again, they're all determined. So essentially, you can tell that from simple as well, if you just let me ignore that little problem, which probably we should have ignored. We should have only defined simple in the first place. We should have said, no, they're not in there. But there are edge problems with these definitions, and you're on right up against the edges. You really didn't care about the edge problems. You only cared about the interior of the set of metrics. But there are problems at the edge. Any other questions?